Welcome to this episode of Conquering Leadership, which is it's bittersweet. It's everything.
Bitter as we come to the close of a rather complex year and also near the end of this series.
But the sweet part is I've got an amazing character and I'm very grateful to introduce someone who needs no introduction, Mike Friday, who's the head coach of the USA Eagles men's sevens team. That's in rugby sevens. I am going to give Mike a brief intro, even though I say he doesn't need an introduction. He was the head coach of the England sevens team. After a stint over there in the UK, he moved to Kenya and coached the Kenyan men's sevens team, the national team, moved them up the world rankings significantly enough, including, if I recall correctly, a win over New Zealand in Wellington, which is an absolute accolade for anyone doing anything in rugby. If you know half a jot of information about rugby, and that's got to be a massive scalp and a massive moment in anyone's world. And then in 2014, he came and took over the US side. And as I read somewhere recently, he started an American revolution of his own kind. And that's evidenced in the way the American team now plays their game and has been consistently in the top three or four in the world in the last few years. And under Mike's tutelage and mentorship has produced some real superstars in the form of Perry Baker, Carlin Isles, Madison Hughes, the list goes on. But I think what's even more significant is Mike's from South London, and so am I originally, and that really closes the loop. So, Mike, thank you so much for your time and for being here. And how's that for an intro?
Well, it's a lovely intro, especially the South London part. Never forget your roots, which I think is a big part of life because it shapes you. So, yeah, no, when I listen to people kind of talk about where I've been in the world, I'm not a hobo. Let's just be clear on that. It's about circumstance, opportunity to make a difference. And I was able to do that with England. I had a fabulous experience with Kenya, some highs and lows there on and off the pitch, and then an equally enjoyable, exhilarating, sometimes frustrating ride that we're on at the moment with USA. But ultimately their experiences and their journeys, and that's the enjoyable bit about all of this, and that you get the opportunity to do something you love, that you're passionate about, and make a difference.
What inspired you to be that kind of person who just wants to make a difference? You don't just wake up, or maybe you do, you just wake up one morning and think, I can make this better, I can be better, and I can make the world a better place.
I don't know, really. I think it's probably in my DNA, although I probably didn't know it as a youngster. But when I played the game, I always wanted to make it better. I always wanted to bring the collective parts together, which is what you get with a yappy, mouthy scrum half, which I lived up perfectly to. But I was driven by winning. Of course, I love to win, and I hate to lose. I'm not sure which way around it is, but the reality is I'm a competitor and I like to compete and I love to make things better. And more importantly, I like to make people better as well. And I think that's a huge driver for me.
Yeah.
So a big part of me is the ability and to assist and help to allow every individual to maximize their potential. That's a big thing for me. That's a big driver for me. And that's a good thing because that means that you constantly push and you invest in those individuals. But more important, I suppose, a negative to that little bit is that you're never quite satisfied, because as soon as you do something, you're on to the next thing, which means that sometimes you don't necessarily reflect as well as you could do or take a little bit of time to enjoy those moments when they happen. And I can resonate with that. But I think it's something that you're kind of innately born with, but then it's down to you as an individual to develop, become self-aware of that, and then maximize the opportunities that your character and the traits of your character provide you with. So, yeah, I mean, I come from a normal background, very, very like a hardworking background. But, you know, from a mum who was very much into human resources and HR. So maybe there's some traits there that I picked up, and innately they're built into you as you grow up. And a dad who, again, hugely supportive, but drove me and supported me. And, you know, you had that mixture of the soft word and the hard word, you know, and sometimes it's the hard words that you remember, and they're the things that you bring forward and you bring into your kind of later life. And, you know, you have those experiences as you move through life, right? Whether you're at school, whether you're at university, when you play in the amateur game, go into the professional game, when you start coaching, when you're at work, your business life, your business career. And it's, are you picking up the good times and the bad times, the good examples, the bad examples, and then what you choose to do with those experiences? And, you know, some of my best experiences are probably my worst experiences, because they gave me the groundings to realize that's not the way to do it.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, I can. I can. And again, it still haunts me, because when I was 17, I think it was, or 17, I think, or 18, I was at I didn't go to a fashionable school, let's just say that way, not a rugby school. And I was at what they would call in America a community college, but we would call it a college of further education, right, in the UK.
Yeah.
That's where I chose to do my A-levels. And I got myself into the county under-90s team. And then they found out I was 17 and they said, well, you're in full-time education. You have to go to the under-18s trials. So they sent me to the under-18s trials, and the first thing you do when you rock up there is they ask for your name, and then they ask for your school. And that's where it went wrong for me, because as soon as they asked for my school and I said Orpington College of Further Education, they just looked down at me, and they'd already judged me. They'd already decided what type of person I was, what type of player I was.
Yeah.
And I sat on the sideline for 77 minutes of the 80 minutes, was put on for 3 minutes to go. Got nothing, and it was the hardest car journey home with my old man, because he was so angry but couldn't articulate and show that anger, because he knew there was that hard done by, but the reality is it wasn't going to help anybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, bizarrely enough, so believe it or not, I didn't get into that 18s. I then turned up a year later back at the 19s, an 18-year-old, and I said, oh, how did it go? Recounted the story, and they couldn't believe it. Interesting enough, the guy that got in at 18s level couldn't get into the club team because they got me to come and play for him. but they're the types of experiences that can shape you in a negative way as well as a positive way. Yeah. You know, when I was younger, I saw that as a very antagonistic, negative thing, and, you know, shaped me in some ways. When I look back now, I probably shouldn't have taken on board.
Yeah,
and probably cost me a couple of opportunities as a result, because you carried that anger. But by the same token, it taught me a valuable lesson that I would never do, and I still will not do to this day. Is that I will never judge a book by its cover.
Yeah,
and which is easier. Sorry, it's harder said than done. You know what I mean? Sorry, easier said than done.
Yeah,
in the we all carry prejudices and biases. Ability to put that one side is that when whatever player I come across, is it's my job, my responsibility to give them the best experience they can have at that time, whether they are good enough or bad enough. And I think that's true in sport and in my business life, where, again, I spent a lot of time in business in terms of managing and building teams and trying to get the best out of them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing to recognize, isn't it, that we do have some intrinsic biases. And I can actually resonate with that. I had some similar experiences, not just in rugby but in business. Parts of South London, as you say, are not fashionable or popular, and don't, their peaks in culture are fairly low. It's interesting that the reason that resonates is because for myself, it forced me into it, like you just said, an intentional learning cycle that became a perpetual motion machine. I just kept going off to do things. Every time someone said, you can't do that, then I'd make a point of going to do it. I went, paid for my way through university, got myself through Naval College, and did a whole bunch of things. Then went off and ran a business, did a whole bunch of things, just because I came from a background that I wasn't supposed to be able to do those things. And it's sort of, as you say, it becomes a driver, but can be a bit negative if you get too fixated on it. I like what you said there about just not judging a book by its cover. Do you see that in rugby right now? There's been a lot of discussion on social media. You've got people like Jason Robinson, which I just recently watched him, and he was formerly of England, talking about being a black rugby player in the England setup, all the way back to players like Chris Oatey. Do you see a change in that culture? Do you see a change in that leadership in the rugby world these days?
Of course, I think we see evolution in everything that's going on. I think there's some emotional subjects, and the subjects that probably Jason talked about and Chris, they're the big topical subjects, okay, which is very clear when you see a change. But yeah, at the micro level, which is ultimately at the team dynamic level, what I would say to all leaders, whether you're leading one person or you're leading 100 person, is it's judging the postman or the tea lady. Do you treat them in the same way as you treat the CEO?
Yeah.
Now, again, we hear it time and time again, but doing it is the key.
Yeah.
Is the reality is that that consistency in how you conduct and hold yourself, irrelevant of the person that you are talking to or interacting with, is critical. And yeah, I think every person in the world gets it wrong.
Yeah.
100%. But I'm a big believer you've got to get it wrong to get it right. But the interesting bit is how many of those individuals are prepared to accept and admit that they have got it wrong and then try and remedy or rectify it. Because egos can get in the way.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that as a world I'm not sure we are getting better at. I think in terms of accepting different opinions and getting to a state where we can agree to disagree, I think is something again where to have good interaction, honest, open debate and discussion about volatile or sensitive issues, and the ability to respect other people's views without judging, is something that in this modern world I question, because it's almost we're creating a world where the best way to deal with things is to say nothing, because your opinion one way or the other is going to cause an issue. None more illustrated than on social media, And that for me is worrying, because the big thing that I encourage and I want with every player that I come across, every player, every person, is you have to have your own opinion. You have to be prepared to voice it. Yes, there's ways in which you can voice it.
Yeah.
But if you haven't got an opinion, and we're not developing our people, our players, to have an opinion and teach them how to articulate that in order to get their message across, one, in a respectful way, but two, in an honest, authentic way, then we are letting those people down. Because socially, we are a pack. That's human nature, is to operate in packs and communities. We have to advocate and lead and drive and create and develop our people to allow them to do that, because then they can maximize their potential. Then the old adage of 1 + 1 = 3 starts to come into play.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And looking where you're at in the world of sports leadership, you deal with some top end athletes, young people who are fueled by testosterone at the top of their game. And athletes are different. They're not always good at articulation of feelings or emotions or concepts. So how do you get them to do that?
Well, it's not easy and it takes time. I mean, ultimately, you've got to build it on very simple human values. You've got to build it on trust, integrity, and consistency. Because I think, especially in the athletic world, that's what these girls and boys look for. They're looking for patterns.
Yeah.
And they're looking to test that you adhere to those patterns. So, for me, being trustworthy, me illustrating to them I'm trustworthy, I've got integrity, and more importantly, I'm consistent, whether that's good or bad. Because, I'm not really bothered whether you're a superstar or whether you're not. There's a right way to behave and a wrong way. How I have those discussions with you may tailor depend on what type of personality you are, but that's the skill set that I've got to develop, and an understanding and appreciation of you as an individual in order to get the best out of you. So you know, you have you as a leader, or me as a leader of these players, I have to work insanely hard at understanding each one of my athletes. So I am emotionally invested in every one of them. And I have to be if I want to maximize their potential, and I have to mold myself around them. It's not a case of them molding themselves around me. It's about me molding myself around them to allow me and allow them to maximize their potential as a person, because then I get a better rugby player. There are, of course, there's the physical, there's the technical, and there's the tactical innovations and the education that we need to do alongside that. Of course, 100%. And, you know, where you start on that when you're evolving a program and a rugby player is their foundations, their pillars. But the problem is a lot of people just focus on the work piece, you know, the physical development, the technical development, the tactical development, to make them good at their job. Okay, but in order to be good at your job, you've got to be a good team player.
Yeah.
That's got nothing to do with physical development, technical or tactical. You've got to be good at being a team player, which means you've got to be a good person.
Right.
And how much time we spend on trying to nurture, develop and evolve them as people so they can be better on the pitch. But it's common sense. If they're better off the pitch, they'll be better on the pitch.
Yeah.
So we have to work very, very hard with them on, you know, simple stuff, communication skills, flexibility of communication, you know, getting them to understand and appreciate that there's more than one way to communicate. And more importantly, just because you like being communicated in that way, it doesn't mean that your fellow teammate does.
Yeah.
So more importantly, do you understand your fellow man or fellow lady in order that you can adjust your language to communicate to them to get the best out of them? And you can see, like, again, and I know we have a lot of synergies here about dogs and the pack. You just see that dog head just tip to the side and the ears poke up. You know what I mean? It's just like, what are you talking about? But again, it takes time because, you know, especially probably with, like you said, testosterone young men, they're all about the on pitch stuff. But the reality is you've got to be an authentic person to be successful on the pitch.
Yeah.
So we've got to help them understand them and understand each other and realize and accept differences. Because one of the biggest things I had to struggle with, and I work hard at and have to continually work hard at, is like in America, the diversity is extreme. Like our USA rugby team represents the country of USA. The diversity is huge. So the chances of miscommunication between me and some of the players, or more importantly, between players and players, is huge.
Yeah.
So you have to work even harder to ensure that we don't have those miscommunications whilst accepting that one of our biggest strengths is our diversity.
Yeah.
But it's very much a balancing game. So,
well, implicit bias is sort of, sorry to cut you off there, but you just rang a bell for me, because implicit bias can be a two-way street. You know, you've got young players who will look at you, and as you say, you've got to walk the walk as the coach, but you want them to walk the walk as players. So it's sort of symbiotic. And, you know, but they're going to have perceptions of you, rightly or wrongly, based on their own backgrounds and their education. So I think the question I want to come to you there, because is a really fascinating point about, and your degree of self-awareness is, I've got to make sure I can communicate effectively. So I've got 7 people in front of me. There's possibility that there's 7 different filters, you know, reconstituting the message. Where did you get trained, or is that something you just picked up through experience?
I think it's a bit of everything, really. I think, like I said, being a gobby, yappy scrum half helped. Understanding people and having an interest in trying to create effective relationships with people.
Yeah.
I'm very, very fortunate. I think my mother was innately in strategic and personnel HR.
Yeah.
So as a consequence, there's probably subliminal learning there. Yeah. Probably that may or may not have been done on purpose by my mum. But the reality is, it's always been a good sounding board to go and get a different perspective and experiences from, even, you know, now. You know, I will use my mum as a sounding board on HR stuff. And when I say HR stuff, on people skills stuff, because she's got, you know, I can't give away her age, but a lot of experience.
Hey, mums are awesome. I go back to mums. There's a lot of wisdom in mums.
100% wisdom, and you know, the foolish person doesn't draw on those wisdoms. Do you know what I mean? And they look at it in a different way. But I also did a lot of research and training myself on flexibility of communication, behavioral skills. Right. I worked with a behaviorist, and I have a keen interest in personalities and understanding personalities, personality testings, and all of that stuff. You know, it's the Myers-Briggs or so forth. So it's something that captures my interest. I, like I said, if you want to live what I want to live, then I've got to invest heavily in trying to make sure I can invest in the people I'm going to work with.
Yeah.
So, you know, and interestingly enough, whatever my kind of journey in life, be it in sport or going into business and managing teams and building teams, it's all transferable.
Yeah.
It's just their drivers are different. You know, in sport, it's win, lose, testosterone. In business, it might not be. It might be I'm doing this for my family. It might be because I want to just be really good at my job. Yeah. You know, the spectrum is far wider in business, right? And there's 100%. A lot more shades of grey. But it just tests you in a different way as somebody that's trying to kind of lead the ship or get the team to push in one direction together. But ultimately it comes down to not just those big conversations.
Yeah.
More importantly, it's the small conversations that you layer on top before and afterwards.
Yeah.
Which allow you to keep everybody pointing the same direction. Because you know what it's like when you've got a group of people, by the very nature is one will just skew off to the left and one will skew off to the right. And where you want to get to is that actually it's the bloke behind him that's just tapping him in. So they're actually self-regulating one another. But ultimately, they still need that person behind them guiding those people. And where I want to get to and where I'm always trying to get to is I also want them to be looking over their shoulder just to check I haven't skedaddled off to the left or the right.
Yeah.
Because that is very, very realistic to happen as well, because when you're in it as a so-called leader, sometimes you can get caught down and not see the head for the trees and get sidetracked, and something that's a small issue you make into a big issue which you didn't need to. And that's, again, if you've done a really good job with your people, is that pop-up management.
Yeah.
You know, in my case, Madison Hughes will pop up and like, do you know what, Mike, I'm not sure we've got that quite right. Now, again, creating and building that confidence in those individuals to accept that the coach isn't always right and there is a different way. And more importantly, as a coach, to realise, actually, that's a better idea than my one.
Yeah, we'll there's room that. For a conversation, isn't there? 100%. Hey, so that's a super segue, actually, into the core of this series of shows and leadership. So for you, Mike, what defines leadership?
For me, it's about empowering and developing and nurturing people. So a leader inspires that person to become the best version of themselves and enables and helps them to do that.
Yeah.
What he doesn't do is just point and say, let's go. Because everybody gets tired then.
Yeah.
Because as a leader, you are in it, but you're in it with them and they're in it with you. And you've got to be an enabler.
Yeah.
Yes, at possible difficult times, you have to be prepared to stand up and make that decision, whatever that decision may be.
Yeah.
So you accept that responsibility and you accept the accountability that comes with that so-called title. But the reality is what you're trying to do is ensure that everybody around you maximizes their potential, because that means as a group, you will maximize your potential. It means you will achieve your goal. So actually, you will all move seamlessly in the direction that you want to do. It's interesting as well. I think when I arrived here, I had a vision, a plan, and a strategy. Okay, so that gave them the boundaries, the framework. But the framework that we started with to where we are now has gone from being mine to ours. And in their words.
That must feel good.
It feels great. I mean, I think like always, it like all things culturally and like all things in an environment, they're living, they're breathing. So the reality is what's worked today that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work tomorrow. So we have to keep moving with the times. But ultimately, they're underpinned and they're driven by human values. And non-negotiable human behaviours. And all I am on that part is I am very, very, very strong on those kind of guardrails. And then that then creates a, let's just say, a field in between where they can all bounce around and be themselves and be individuals, and we can develop and evolve and grow, but we're all moving in one direction. Now, you know, what defines success? Do you know what I mean? Is success shiny things, or is success that player maximized his potential and became the best version of himself? And the answer to that is dependent on
who you're speaking to.
100%. But I'm more of the line of the way I look at things is if I do everything I can to help this person be the best person they can be, which will allow them to be the best player they can be, then ultimately we should get better results most of the time or more of the time. Whether or not we win the shiny thing, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I'm quite competitive. And I've walked that journey and I love picking up a bit of tin, but on the coaching side, I love what you're saying about transformational leadership, because I took a bunch of young fellas here and just sort of this bit of leadership and rugby coaching combined. And I said, what do you want to do? And they said, we want to play in the highest level tournament we could play. Went, all right, well, where do you want to go with that? Because I can get you into some tournaments, but there's a lot of yardage there on your end. And they went into every tournament as underdogs. And if they got a win, it was a bonus, because they knew that they were overstretching themselves physically, mentally and emotionally. And one of the last games, one of the fondest memories, and it was sevens footy for a lot of them, was playing against Germany prior to the Olympic at the Las Vegas Sevens. Now, they got reamed a new one on every level. But in the pool round, they were the only team in the pool that put a try on Germany. And that's the one thing they talk about all the time. Yeah.
But that's exactly what, that's a positive experience. And you know what it's like is when you're the underdog, you've got very little to lose.
Yeah.
And this is the journey we've been on here with this mob. Because, you know, I'm driven by helping people maximize their potential. But you know what it's like, the pressures change and evolve. Because when you, once you stop being the underdog, you know, that's where you almost have to continue to drive and persevere and still be that hungry, underdog.
Yeah.
But as soon as you think you can rest up and your stomach is full, you know, there's another dog coming up behind you. That's another interesting learning dynamic for younger people to realize and recognize, is that once you get to a table and you eat, you've got to remember what got you there in order to stay there. And right. I often have conversations with them. It's like the easy bit's getting there, the hard bit is staying there. And that then takes kind of discipline, resilience, and a number of other traits which you had in a different form when you were working so hard to get there, because that was more around the grit and the work ethic.
Yeah.
Well, okay, they've got to be given, you know. And I think those types of lessons, understandings and challenges for people as they grow and maximize their potential are crucial.
Yeah. So who inspired you to become the leader that you are today?
Do you know what? But you see, I don't call myself that. If that's the point, like people say, well, I'm just here to try and do everything I can with this group in order that we can achieve what we want to achieve. I mean, there's some people I draw upon, you know, and experiences, you know, there's guys, it's interesting, right? So some of these people won't know some of these names, right? But when I was back at Wasps, okay, and like Wasps Rugby Club has moved around, right? Everybody says, where are Wasps from? Are they from Sudbury? Are they from High Wycombe? Are they from Coventry? Ultimately, when I played for Wasps, we trained out of Sudbury town in northwest London. We played at Sudbury, then we moved to Loftus Road.
Yeah.
But when I was coming through the ranks, like at Wasps, it didn't matter who you were. When you walked through the doors, you're just Mike. And the reality is you earn what you earn from being the man you are when you walk through these doors. I'm not interested where you've been, what you've done.
Yeah.
You're taken for who you are. You're not judged. All of the things that are important to me. But there was a couple of guys there that were, there was a guy there called Francis Emerua, right? So he would have been the first black guy to probably play for for England. But he got gangrene in his leg before Chris Oatey got capped, because Chris was at Wasps as well.
Yeah.
But Francis, like, he was the hardest man I've ever come across. He was also the softest spoken guy off the pitch that looked after the youngsters. He taught us how to be gentlemen. Yeah. He taught us manners, but he also ensured nobody ever took liberties with the young guys. Now, yeah, the reality is, back in those days, you had to fight your way through in terms of learning how it ran. But he taught me about some key behaviours and values and how you should treat people and how people should be expected to be treated. Yeah. So they live with you. I then had a captain there called Mark Rigby, who stayed with me as a mentor, really kind of through, not just through rugby, but also through when I was in business, similar sort of trade. He was kind of 10, 15 years ahead of me, but he ran teams, people, was very, very much kind of the talisman, but very considered, very educated in life and how to treat people and get the best out of people. So I learned a lot from him, and I look at Francis, I look at him, I then look at, you know, some coaches. Like, I had a very little time, but with Gatland, in terms of how he goes about his business. And again, I take bits from that. I take bits from a couple of coaches who I won't name, who basically gave me the clear vision of that's not how you treat people,
right,
and that's no way to behave.
Yeah.
That layered on top with my upbringing with my mum and my mum and dad, like my mum, as we talked about on the HR perspective, and my old man on the, you get your head down and you work hard, and life's not fair.
Yeah.
Understand that. But, you know, you've got to drive yourself to try and be the best version of yourself. So, you know, there are many, many things and people that I kind of, if I reflect, I kind of draw upon. And it, like I said, it's some of those experiences that were really negative on you that transfer across to ensure that you probably are a better person for those that you get the opportunity to work with.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And I always raise it at this point in the show, because when I created this show, I was expecting people to go, yeah, it's like, pick a public figure. And almost everyone, I think, apart from one, and this will be what, the 12th, 13th show on this theme, has gone back to people in their history or their local environment who's inspired them to be better. And they pick aspects of each individual. And I said, yeah, I'm going to take a piece of this and a piece of this person and apply it to their own lives. That was, it's an unexpected bonus, because it really, I was really expecting something different. And that's very, very cool, because I do the same thing as I've been on this journey. I look back at my time and drew down from people saying, well, I'd like to be like that person when I grow up. And yeah, there's a person over there that's like, oh wow, they're a yellow flag and a red flag for leadership. There's no way I'm going down that way. That's really cool to hear. And I, a couple of times I've reached out over time and just sent people a message just out of the blue. I spent 12 years in China and say, hey, just want to let you know, you inspired me and I still remember you, just because they had such a big impact. And I think by the sounds of it, Mike, you're going to do the same for other people. You're going to transform them and they're going to look back and be talking about you. And it's good for you. I want to come back to a theme though you mentioned earlier about not giving yourself time to sort of stop and smell the roses on the way. And I think to be a good coach or a good executive these days, you have to drive yourself through intentional learning cycles. So you're obviously aware of the fact that you've got to take a step back and just enjoy the sunshine. And there's a lot of people out there who are in similar roles, not necessarily as higher pressure, but they're also struggling. So what are a couple of pieces of advice you would give to folks to say, right, here's what I need to do before I fall down a hole, got to take a step back and enjoy the sunshine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I'm going to be very good at answering this. Because the reality is, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm very aware of it. That it's a weakness of mine, and the reason is I can't be content, and that's dangerous. That is dangerous. That's dangerous for me. That, you know, because the reality is that I get that insane high when I see that smile from that player, when you can see that it's they got what they wanted for that moment, whether it's a trophy win or whether it's whatever. And then I'm on to the next one. And that's where I have tried to find outside releases, if I'm honest with you.
Yeah.
And I'm so fortunate. I've got, you know, my two sons are fantastic young men, and they're becoming, you know, fantastic guys, you know,
yeah.
17 now and 14. So, you know, those moments I have with them of just being like a dad, and they're both into their rugby, right? So the biggest thing for me is when I go and watch them at school, I go and watch them, everybody's looking down the touchline, right? He's going to get involved. He's going to do this. And I'm like, they must think I'm the rudest person in the world, because I will stand at the end of the pitch with my cup of tea and just say nothing. Cause you know me well enough to know that I've got plenty to say about refereeing, officiating, when it's my team, because I'm driven by injustice. So the reality is I've got all of those emotions I constantly have to contain and work on the side of the pitch anyway.
Yeah.
So when they see me, when I watch my sons, and I purposely stay away because I see how everybody else is, and I don't want to be like that. I just want to enjoy them. I just want to enjoy the moment of like coming to watch my sons play and them enjoy what they do.
Yeah.
And so that's part of my release. Interesting that I also have got now better at, I'll go into the woods and with the dogs, and yeah. not the American dogs, my own dogs, and you know, and I'll walk there, and my mind might tick over on what I'm doing and things like, because that's for me that changes a rest, and I have to work very hard on finding a bit of time for myself in the gym,
yeah.
And that's another time, and there's, you know what it's like, especially when we get to our age as well, right? You go through those kind of highs and lows of wanting to do it and not wanting to do it,
yeah.
And as a former pro, for me it's pointless going to the gym unless you get to end yourself,
right?
But the reality is when you're our age, it's like, mate, you can't end yourself no more, otherwise you will literally end yourself. So I make sure I find time for that, and it's those little things, you know, and
yeah.
And you know, I'm trying to find time away to not get involved. I'll be honest with you, it's been very difficult these last 9 months to do that. And that you again have got to work really hard to find time to do that, be proactive and disciplined, and not see it as you're letting people down by not doing that, because if you don't do it, you don't build it into your week, you're not going to be in the best shape to do what you need to do for them. So that's would be my tips. The problem, I feel a bit of a fraud to say, do I achieve that every week? No, I don't. But yeah. I endeavour to try and achieve that every week.
Yeah.
And sometimes I need a little bit of help, and there's people just yanking me, and they're chucking my phone to the side, saying, "You don't need to deal with that now."
Yeah, let
because
it go.
I am the type of person that likes to deal with things as soon as we can, because I don't want to leave people hanging or waiting.
Yeah.
I want to continue to allow the train to keep moving forward, but. You know, you do have to accept that there's a time and a place where you can't do that.
That's super valuable. And you know, I come back to my very short and unspectacular career in the military. But one of the things that resonated and I've kept in my leadership roles over the years, both, you know, off field in the world of business and on field in the world of sports, is looking after yourself isn't selfish. And if you don't look after yourself, you're actually going to be ineffective in your leadership role. But to your point, when you care about what you do, it's very difficult to walk that walk.
Yeah.
And I love your thing about training. Yeah. I used to go in the gym and just smash. I wouldn't walk out till I was in a bucket. And my missus, she's a lover of rugby, loves all sport, but she's never been an athlete. She's a cultural athlete. She knows opera. She knows painting.
Yeah.
Why do you do this? And I went, give a dog a bone. Why does a dog chew a bone? I just can't help it.
You just don't have to chew it to the end, right? Which is what you're supposed to do when you play.
Yeah, so that's a nice area there, because I'd like to ask you about, and a few people I've had on before in the world of HR and the military world, we've had a little skirted around the subject of mental health awareness, and looking after yourself is not always easy, particularly in, like, as you say, for athletes who are very determined. Where are we getting it right in rugby? And or are we getting it right? Because it is a top table subject these days.
I don't know whether we're getting it right, if I'm honest with you. I mean, I'm a bit, like I said, I come back to, I think in rugby especially, we have the responsibility to develop the man or the woman holistically.
Yeah.
And I don't think developing the man or woman holistically is dragging them out of school at 18 and straight into a full-time rugby environment, because you want them to be international world-class players by the time they're 21. I look at the way that the Americans have the scholastic model, and I can't help but think, if we were creating well-rounded individuals in the professional game, actually experiencing different social circles at university and college,
yeah,
you know, actually mixing with people that don't actually like rugby,
yeah,
and having different views and perspectives from those people and experiences would be nothing but a bonus. I think that what has to happen is that we need to change the academy system in rugby to ensure that in those first two or three years where you may be professionally contracted to a club, your training is worked around your education, be it an educational course or yeah, be it a practical course,
yeah,
an apprenticeship, whereby you are not just mixing with rugby players. You are mixing with people from different backgrounds, different drivers, different priorities,
yeah,
and different goals, because you become more of a balanced individual and you create other relationships other than just with rugby players.
Do you think you're aware of that? Because you and I played in an era that was pre-professionalism, and one of the things I still hold very, very dear about rugby, which keeps me in the game, is that rugby was the sport I grew to love. Also, there was people in rugby environments who had real lives outside of rugby, and rugby was sort of a byproduct of, or a hobby or whatever. And the modern professional game seems to have rejected some of that. So is your awareness of history, yeah, forming your decision, or is there something else in that, I think, is what I'm coming to?
No, well, I think it's a bit of both, really. I mean, I was part of that. You know, community clubs work for that very reason you just said. You know, when we were playing rugby and the what you would call the professional amateur era, yes, you had those eclectic personalities that play for the club. What we have right now, and I was part of the crew that transitioned and accepted in 18-year-olds when I was kind of playing at Wasps. There was, yeah, the lot that came in at 18, 19. All they ever wanted and all they ever knew was, I want to play rugby.
Right.
And it's like, this isn't going to last forever, one. And two, there's plenty more in the world that will make you a better person, which ultimately will make you a better rugby player. But it just means that we're going to take a little bit more time to nurture and mature you.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need you to be playing for England at 21 years old. We don't need you to be we need you to be a better person and a better rugby player. And that's not to say that there aren't some great 21-year-olds that have come on and have been fantastic. But we're catering for the whole, not just the top 1%, you know. And I think, for me, there has to be a better system in order to achieve that, because I think then we will get a better result for the guys that are in their late 20s and early 30s that are now leaving the game.
Yeah.
Where the stock answer is, well, I want to be a coach. Well, I don't even know whether or not you've got the skill sets to be a good coach. You might be a good physical coach or a technical or a tactical coach, but are you a good people's coach?
Yeah.
So, you know, and you know, the problem we've got in our system is that a lot of clubs employ a coach because he was a good player, yeah, not necessarily a good person,
yeah,
or a well-rounded person, or a person that can develop and enable others, when actually the reason he was a good player was because he did his job. Yeah. So you know, and you know, that's the only reason a lot of players say that is because that's all they know. Well, if they've had these different experiences in their late teens and early 20s, and we, yeah, can continue to develop and make kind of development, industry development or enhancement through their rugby career, and we invest in them, then actually we'll probably get a better man during their rugby career and afterwards. I mean, you look at what we do we do it in a very low level at the USA Men's Sevens. We run a care program whereby, yeah, you have to do an internship,
yeah,
through the year. We'll whatever you want to do, whether it's educational or whether it's, I want to learn how to weld, I want to go and see what happens in city life.
Yeah.
You know, we try and create opportunity. We're very lucky with the philanthropy part of our organization, the Golden Eagles, to try and create those opportunities.
Yeah.
But I think that creates a better chance of creating a better, more rounded and balanced individual that will be better equipped to deal with the traumas and the pressures that come with being a professional rugby player, and more importantly, what comes afterwards. Because if you ask a lot of rugby players and they say, well, if they tell them who they are, they'll say they're a professional rugby player. And like, that's not who you are, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And there is a big difference, you know?
Yeah.
And getting them to understand and see them and not value themselves because of what they do is hard, it's tough. And, you know, we who run the game and are building the game have a responsibility to ensure that we create that environment whereby that's not the case.
Yeah, 100%. I can't pick any holes in that. I love that thought process, mindset. It's just so important. And I sadly, I came back to the game about 11 years ago and I was quite surprised at how many people have sort of got a vacuum in their lives because they've overinvested, if you like, and in overinvested in something that wasn't going to take them where they wanted to go. Man, we could pick that one to pieces forever. But I do want to ask you, when I actually going back to that time period, just over a decade or around a decade ago, my return to rugby was over in Asia. So Sevens was prolific. And I think that's when you were heading up at Kenya. And I remember watching those fellas play. And I was really just, I'm a lover of rugby full stop, but I do love Sevens. It's very gladiatorial. There's nowhere to hide. Despite my massive frame, I did play a bit of Sevens as well. So I think I want to ask you a couple of questions around here, and you can pick up on anyone you like. So going into that gladiator environment in Sevens, it must be a huge adrenaline rush. Right, even for a coach, I'd have thought. So what I'd like to do is explore some of those feelings and then extend the question on to, and how do those feelings ramp up or fluctuate when you go up against New Zealand? And then what happens when you beat New Zealand?
Is this Kenya specifically?
Kenya specifically, because Kenya, talk about underdogs. You've done some fantastic work with the US, but I'd love to come at it from the Kenya angle.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Kenya experience, life experience for me was unbelievable. Full stop. Like to go to Africa and work with Kenya and see, it made me think about the game differently. When you come from being in England and you become lazy with what you've got, because you've got everything, you've got access to everything. When I went to Kenya, and I've told this story so many times, and I rock up and all I'm given is a bag of balls and some cones, it makes you think about the game in the purest sense.
Yeah.
The Kenyan boys were 10 minutes late to the first session, which on their timing, they thought they'd done a good job. But the long and the short of it is there was the give and take. I had to think about the game differently, and they had to think about how they approached the game differently. So they weren't late much after that. To be fair to them, you know, we put the boundaries in place on expectations, disciplines, the values and respect and how you can do that. And in turn, we built the loyalty part, the trust, and very much in the African way is that, you know, that they always look at you and say, well, why are you doing that for me? There must be something in it for you. That's sadly a part of it's quite common ground. So getting them to understand that that's not how I operate took a bit of time, but we got where we needed to get to, which allowed us to build this very authentic, hardworking environment whereby it was, as it became the shoes your pride. You know, we were a pride of lions that hunted and worked together. Now you had some physical athletes, right? They're specimens that just needed direction on maximizing their capability physically. And then we could work on them technically and tactically, because from a people standpoint, they have quite strong values in terms of their history, their background. You know, they come from sub tribes, but four main tribes. So I had to understand that And I they taught me that. They taught me that, which was great, because they could see, well, you know, why is the Otoyo interested in this? You know, but again, but by the same token, it's that appreciation that I want to know about you as the person, not just you as a, I've got an emotional interest in you.
Yeah.
So it was a phenomenal journey, just in terms of the way that they transformed themselves physically, how they started to unleash their potential technically and tactically, because technically that was the problem.
Yeah.
Because they'd all been taught wrong, basically.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They had to reteach them the skills of the game. But then there's that whole kind of belief and motivational and understanding the man and building that within the group, which, if I'm honest, it took time, but we also got a little bit of luck because it really went well for us in Tournament 1. And we shocked the world because physically they'd had 4 months of conditioning, but quality directional conditioning with considered supplement help.
Yep.
Which they'd never had before. So these boys had never had nitric oxide. Okay. Yep. Right. When you give these boys nitric oxide and they're working hard on the weights, these boys just pop abs. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, literally, I made them when we ran out that first warm up in Gold Coast, right? Like when we arrived, all the teams just looked as like, who are these people? Like, what have you done with them? So first warm up, I said, right, lads, we're warming up in vests. Like normally I'd let them warm up in t-shirts or warming up in vests. And they're like looking at me like, no, we're one of them. And literally they trotted out as one as vests. And like literally the Kiwis, the Aussies, the English were like, oh my God. Like it looked like 300, like the Warriors just. And
they were absolute specimens, man.
Yeah. You see, it was interesting, like the young men, right? And it's about the psyche. They saw that everybody was looking at them and they could smell a little bit of fear.
Yeah.
And you just see them all, you saw them rise onto their toes. And then you're like, okay, we've got someone here. Let's see how we ride. Now we rode the roller coaster on consistency because of our technical and tactical evolution.
Yeah.
But what you saw in Wellington, when we turned over the Kiwis on their own yard in extra time, was just young men having that moment.
Yeah.
And we were phenomenal. And we won that. And we went to the final. We played England in the final, right? We lost that final from in extra time, but we had to play the last 2 minutes with five men. That's where sevens is so cruel, because they deserved to win it, but it didn't happen because they were down to five men. And it's just, it's just disappointing. But for me, I couldn't have been any prouder of what they were and who they'd become and what they'd achieved. But for them, there was still that kind of that little moment of we didn't win it. And I'm like, well, no, you didn't. But life ain't fair.
Yeah. And the
Kenyan boys know that life ain't fair. Trust me, they know that that life isn't fair. But I said that doesn't take away from what you've done, who you are, and the way that you've carried yourself. And that ultimately is the keys. Now, when you talk to a lot of the Kenyan people, they might talk about the tournament they won in Singapore a couple of years later. But the reality is the tournament they all talk about is Wellington.
And that must give you a moment. You're super humble and you must look back on that and just feel, man, that was awesome.
I loved every moment with them. Those boys are like we would go to war together day in, day out. And we did. Yeah. We did a lot of going to war, not just in on the series. We also went to Sri Lanka and did the same. And we had some great moments off the pitch because their personalities and as people, again, they grew as men. And you know, you see glimpses of the Kenyan humour. The way that they do their stuff when they score tries, but trust me, that's nothing to the Kenya humour when the boys are all in mischief away from the pitch. So,
well, your impact and influence rippled out, because when the boss lady and myself were leaving Asia to come over here to the US, we come to Vegas and we'd seek out the Kenyan part of the stadium because. We loved watching it, and there's absolute super. I even had a Kenyan rugby shirt out there at one point.
Yeah, they loved Vegas, didn't they? The Kenyans. You know they loved Vegas? They said they love Vegas because they can party as well. Like, yeah. So I used to go into the stands, even when I was with the US, because there was obviously some of the board, some of the board members I still knew and some people. Yeah. And they just, you know, they'd be like, Otoyo, Otoyo. The nickname they gave me, which was the hyena. I don't know why. I think it's because I was snapping at everything. I kept the vultures away. But, you know, they're just fantastic, fantastic people.
Awesome. Right. So we are getting close to the end of this. And so I do always have a few questions I love to close the show out with. So I'm going to give you a little sum up of your leadership layer cake, which involves empowerment, nurturing, developing, inspiring, being industrious and tenacious, being authentic and consistent. This is my interpretation of some of your language. So tough question number one, who out there in the world today do you see as an embodiment of those characteristics?
Oh, that's tough. I'd probably just the way he goes about his work, I would probably say Gatland.
He always looks really grumpy to me.
Yeah, but that's his poker face, because he's another one of the mischief men.
Really?
Yeah, no.
You caught me off guard there. I wasn't expecting you to respond so promptly. So the next one I come to is I've been on a leadership journey for a lot of years, and the two things that over time that's kept me balanced and stopping me going down, you know, rabbit runs and dark places and all that, music, love music and reading. So what's the one piece of music and or book that you would go back to just to keep yourself balanced?
Well, if it's music, I'm you're probably going to, well, it's probably one of two people I'll end up being, but dependent, but it'll either be Pink or Adele.
Go on, can you expand that thought?
Well, just like Adele, obviously she's a South London girl.
Oh, there you are.
but her music just calms me, and I like melodies, even if I'm singing along in my head, because I'm not allowed to sing out loud, and that's why I like Pink. I mean, I like Pink because I like her as a character. I like her as a person.
Yeah.
I like the fact that she speaks her mind, whether I agree or not is a non-point. I like her as a person. She's gritty. She's effervescent, and she's robust, but she can also sing. She can proper sing. So that would be where I go there. Now you've hit my Achilles heel, right? Cause reading, I know this is probably the one thing I shouldn't say. I hate reading.
For an intentional learner, that's quite an admission.
Yeah, I'm much more about conversations and spending time with people. But interesting enough, the books I would always go back to are the Daniel Goleman books on emotional intelligence and leadership. Because what he did, like fair player, this is my mum made me buy the books and encouraged me to read them. Yeah. And actually, I read them so quickly because they caught me. Once they had me, then I wasn't putting it down. But it was the first part of the books are quite all about the brain and understanding the brain. And you get through that. Then it was about kind of life examples. So when you were reading the books, you were like, oh, I can relate to that. Oh, I know so-and-so. He's like that. So again, I need that relatable. I need to be able to relate it to things for it to tick with me. So I'm more interested in watching things like some TED Talk stuff and that type of stuff. But again, it's probably my Achilles heel is I need to be better. And it's interesting. It's something that I'm working on now, be better at testing myself and pushing those boundaries, whether that's through audio books or through reading, because I don't do it enough. You know, you go back to that thing about finding time for you.
Yeah.
It's all part of my plan.
I respect it though, and I have empathy with it, because when I got into executive leader roles, you know, one of the hardest things is picking up a book. It actually has to become sort of a trained skill, if you like. And I went through a period where I'd get I had a stack of books by the side of the bed that all read one third, one half, one part way through, but never finished ones. 100%. So we talked about walking the walk earlier and how tough that is. So in order to enable you to continue walking the walk on your leadership journey, what's the one luxury you take with you for the remainder of your journey to make sure you're always walking the walk?
Jesus. Oh, that's a toughie. What's the one thing I take with me to make sure that I'm always being me? Probably a picture of my sons. Because ultimately is if when all said and done, I just want them to be proud of me as a person. So I could just if I can do that, then I know that I've been a good person.
Yeah.
And you know, for all of your traits that you can be, and we all have good and bad ones, is that, you know, if I know I've been a good person and they know that, then I'm pretty sure I'll be in a decent place, and that will keep me on my checks and balances, because that means that I will fight for them.
Yeah.
And if I'm fighting for them, that means I'm fighting for everybody that I'm with.
Yeah.
But by the same token, that gives me perspective on, ultimately, though, Dad, you're a good man. Because sometimes you can fight too hard, especially for one of my traits, which is injustice. So then sometimes you can lose that perspective. And it's important that you're able to bring yourself back and reflect, take a step back and go, hold on a minute, is this you, or is this for us? Like, and that's a tough one when you're emotionally in a moment.
No, good for you. And I hear that. We all get our little soapboxes that we get on now and again. So that just leaves me to thank you ever so much for giving up your time and being a guest on this show. And just sharing with us your insights into leadership, your absolute sterling character. And it's good to know you, Mike, and really appreciate what you've done here.
Thanks for having me on. It's been good fun. Cut the South East London boys.